This is the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. Join us as Canada's cinematographers discuss the tools and techniques they use in shaping the aesthetics of their current projects.
This podcast features Ron Stanitz, CSC, in conversation with Carolyn Wong of the CSC. This interview was recorded in Vancouver on January 20th, 2019.
CSC. So Ron, you're Australian. When did you move to Canada? Like, how did you start out?
I started out in Australia. I guess I worked as a cameraman in Sydney for, I really started in Townsville. I had just come out of school and I was being trained to be on the other side of the camera, strangely enough.
Strange indeed.
Who would have thunk, you know? But yes, my mother had me from the age of six or something studying speech and drama. So I used to compete in all the Estedfords and everything like that and stand up and do my poems and whatever. And at one stage there was an adjudicator because they all came over from England who wanted to take me back to London and put me into a Shakespearean company. But my parents thought I was too young to go to London, you know, at that age. So anyhow, I wanted to get into the business one way or the other, and I got a job as a driver and started at a brand new television station in Townsville. In those days, there were no schools, so you learnt from other people's experience. And that was it. You were thrown in. Everything was live, so, you know, easy to make mistakes, and mistakes weren't tolerated. So you either made it or you didn't. It's a bit
sink or swim.
It's exactly like that. You know, if you couldn't swim, you were going down.
So were you using, like, newsreel film cameras?
No, here's the deal. I was doing master control directing and audio operating. Then I went into booth announcing, and then I had a children's show. And the film supervisor, Trevor Haywood, he said, look, we've got this Bell & Howell camera, and I'm going out to shoot the races, the horse races. Would you come with me and give me a hand? And yeah, you worked 7 days a week in those days, because if you didn't, you didn't learn anything and you fell behind. So I went out with him. He taught me how to use the camera. He taught me how to use the processor, which, by the way, in Australia, it was outside attached to the studio. So every time you opened the door up, you checked for wild animals such as snakes and spiders and stuff like that, because the processor in those days was total darkness, and that was very freaky. Here's the clinch on how I became a cinema photographer. I was sitting at home waiting for the car to pick me up to go up and do a shift. I think I was doing master control directing on the weekend. And on the Trevor told me that he was going to do a skydive. And over the radio came a news flash that a skydiver had jumped out and his static line was not attached and he didn't make it. And I knew exactly who it was when this news item came across. What happened after that was no one knew how to operate the processor, no one knew how to operate the camera. And the Olympics were coming up, the Melbourne Olympics, and all the squad was coming up to Townsville to train in our beautiful Olympic pool. And they said, can you go and get us footage of it? And I said, yeah, sure, I can do that. So I went down, and all of a sudden I realized I'm as close to my idols as I am to you right now. And I thought, wow, this little camera can get me that close. I was rubbing shoulders with the greats, the Dawn Frasers, the Murray Roses, all my swimming idols. And I thought, wow, this is really, really good. And that's where it started. And I left the commercial station. I was offered a job at the ABC with my own sports show on television, 5 days a week, breakfast announcer. So I did that for, I don't know, must have been 6 months or something. And then I got a call from a production manager that went to Sydney to open up a new station, which ended up being part of the Murdoch network, and said, would you like to come down? There's an opening for a C-grade cameraman studio, you know, one way into the big smoke without having to wait or be a waiter or something. So down I went, you know, and I saw the cameramen that were already employed, and they were all from other networks. And so I said, hey, I don't know anything about this camera. I said, how about I go and buy you beers, and you take me back and show me how to use the camera. Like, good idea. So that's what we did. We went to the pub, had a few beers, came back, and they showed me how to do it. Well, I lasted 3 months on that and then got fired from it because it was quite a funny thing because, you know, they were very emphatic about the fact that, you know, you had your headset on and lights would come on in the camera when your camera was live. And this is all live. And the director says, standby camera three, ready, three, dolly. And we're doing this little show called Folk Moot, which was a live, which was a coffee room set, you know, with tables and chairs and a little stage. And he kept me going, and you didn't stop until you were told to stop. And I hear crash, bang, boom. And I'm dolling forward, you know, very precise, holding nice. And I was dollying through the set of tables and chairs and whatever. And then finally he said, stop it! What are you doing? I said, well, sir, the lights are still on. You haven't said stop. So that was insubordination. And
well, what did he expect? He didn't say stop, and you were doing
exactly.
What?
But hey, you know, I was only, well, I was only 19, 20, what?
Cut your
life. Yeah. So I immediately got a job. They transferred me into the news department because I knew how to use a bell and that.
So you went totally fired.
So I went totally into film and in a very short while was nominated for a rank award in, for a news item that I had covered, which was a huge department store fire in Sydney. The rest is history. I just went on from there, you know.
Did you do any drama when you?
No,
you didn't do any drama before.
No,
you came
it was all current. It was all current affairs and news back in that in those days. And then in '69, I came here, got a job at CFTO in Toronto, and that lasted for a little while. And I was not that excited about it. Wanted to go back to Australia at the end of that year because my job was still available. But I was married at that time, and she didn't want to go back to Australia, so I thought, oh, well, I've got to bite the bullet. And just at that time, I got offered a contract with CTV to do all their documentaries. And at that time, documentaries were Canadian content. There wasn't much drama being done in those days. And so for the next 5 years, and I was living in Toronto, for the next 5 years I worked 2 weeks in Toronto. The rest was all over the world shooting documentaries. And there were documentary series like Five Portraits of Canada, Heritage Canada, Window on the World, you know, great documentaries.
And what would you be shooting those on?
16 mil.
What cameras?
Well, I had my own BL, 16 BL. Which was quite heavy. And then I bought the SR, and I had a complete set, Arri SR set. And, yeah, I went everywhere. I mean, I remember just one of the shows, and it went from shooting beautiful pictures to, you know, heavy-duty documentaries, one being on the IRA, which after I was in New York doing a sex education show, with Norm Perry, got a call and they said, you're on a flight to Belfast tomorrow morning. And I said, I'm not equipped to go to Belfast. I said, I'm in New York. And they said, what do you need? I said, well, I need my boots. They said, we'll have them. So the sound man I was with didn't want to go, and it was after Sunday Bloody Sunday. Sunday Bloody Sunday had just happened, and we had been sent over to do a story on the IRA and to cover the March of Newry, where the Catholics were going to march on the British guns. Of all people, Rodney Charter was my sound man, and off we went. And that was pretty. That was pretty scary. Pretty scary.
Well, it's such a rich time to be shooting very historical.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. No. I mean, I've seen a movie. I can't remember the name of it, but a director in Toronto, a woman director, did it, and it was like just brought back that whole trip we did, you know, because it was based on pretty much on that time.
Now, in those days, you'd have to have some kind of lighting package just to get an exposure on film that the ASA maybe was kind of low. Or
yeah, I think that I had a four-colortran light, and I had them wired to dual-wired in a Y adapter, so two lights going into one plug with 110 bulbs in them, because I just found the 240 bulbs shoot, and we were shooting a lot in Europe, so hence they were pretty standard in the kit. The 240 volt bulbs in the color trans just used to blow so easy, and that was expensive, you know, whereas the 110s just went on forever. So here we are with my color trans lights all wired up. We hit Dublin, Rodney and I. We go to an electrical store and we buy every adapter that we can find, because we're going into Belfast and then we're going up to Newry. We cross over the border and the customs has been bombed and it's still smoking. So we thought, well, keep driving. Keep driving.
That's a pass.
We got taken to a place in Northern Ireland where we were to meet the head of the IRA, and I was told that we had a gentleman that was our contact into the IRA, and he'd taken us to about three pubs on three different nights, and we used to walk into the pub, and the whole pub would just go quiet. We'd stay there and look at each other, and then say, okay, you can go now. And they were checking us out, because the SS was impersonating as press and infiltrating. So they wanted to check out that we were bona fide. And the very last pub we went into, we were standing there, and like even the barman would go down to the end of the bar, and we'd stand there and we'd be by ourselves, and it was so quiet and it was dark. We were just wondering what the hell's happening in this pub. And next minute this flute started, and it was playing a Irish war song. And it was just coming from somewhere in the back of the pub. I got to tell you, of all the things I've done in my life, that put the hair up on the back of my neck really, really big time.
And so what did it mean, the flute?
I think it was a signal to everybody that was in the pub for something, apart from we didn't know whether it was a signal of approval, whether what it was, have no idea. Scariest thing I've ever been in.
There's some intense documentary. I'd like to, you know, jump ahead, because you do a lot of your background is a lot of television series in Canada, and you're still sort of doing some.
Yeah.
So how did you get, you know, from this documentary background? What was your first dramatic?
The first dramatic was I'm trying to think now which came first. I went to Montreal, and I lived in Montreal for about 6 years and worked with the wonderful Robin Spry doing commercials, and Robin did two feature films, so I shot the feature films plus a whole lot of commercials. And then I came back in to Toronto and worked in GW commercials with Robert Fleck, and worked there for a while. It was an offspring of CFTO GW commercials, and they did a promotional thing on me as their staff cameraman and director of photography, and labeled me Ritzy Ron, which has stuck in my family for years. In fact, I got a Christmas present this year from my cousin saying, "Ritzy Ron, try these socks."
And were you Ritzy? Why? Because why the Ritzy?
Not sure. It was Bob Flex impersonation of me. I don't know. You know, I think it was all being in commercials. It was sort of something to sell. Then I got a call. I got an agent at that time, and I got a call to do. The CBC was interested in me doing a drama for them. And I got immediately on the same day or something, I got a call that Lonesome Dove was interested in me. I really wanted to do a Western. And I said, Lonesome Dove said, "Well, we'll get back to you in 10 days. And CBC wanted an immediate answer. And I said to the agent, "If you want to keep me, you get me Lonesome Dove." And he did.
Within 10 days? Before the
10 days? Before the 10
yeah,
days.
Yeah.
I went out to Calgary, and it was the best 2 years of my life. Unfortunately, the show didn't go. They changed producers, and the new producers wanted Unforgiven, and we had like Little House on the Prairie kind of approach to Lonesome Dove. And it was a family show. It was up at the top of the ratings, and then it went to Unforgiven. And I can remember being in a dentist's chair in Bragg Creek. The dental assistant was a woman and had children and whatever. And the dentist very proudly said, "Oh, this is Ron Stannett. He's the director of photography of Lonesome Dove." And she hit the roof. And I'm standing there with my mouth wide open, can't say anything, and she's berating upon me because of the terrible change that had happened to Lonesome Dove, that had become violent, and she couldn't allow her children to watch it and everything like that. So then I was quite sure when Lonesome Dove finished, it ended. I ended the show with breaking my pelvis because I thought I was a cowboy, and that didn't work out too well. I don't know. I've had a bit of downtime because I was 3 months in a wheelchair and then went on from there. And I can't remember offhand what I went on to next, but it seemed to be drama mostly at that time.
I just remember I met you on Top Cops.
Oh yeah, Top Cops.
I forgot all
about Top Cops, but I think Top Cops came before Lonesome Dove.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yes, no, you're right.
Yeah, actually, no, yeah, that's right. I'd forgotten about Top Cops.
Oh.
That was pretty much the turnover from GW Commercials. It wasn't Lonesome Dove. Lonesome Dove came after Top Cops, and Top Cops I think was 5 years or something.
Yeah, I mean, it was at the time. It was a bit of a groundbreaking kind of series.
Oh, it was. It was.
You know,
it
no
was
had
great.
Whole...
That's right, because it was almost the first kind of dramatic stuff in Canada.
Semi-reality dramatic stuff.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
You would talk to the real cops, and then you dramatize
And then
the
you
story
dramatize their story. Exactly.
It was good. It was a big shoot, like in Toronto, really... monopolize a lot of crews.
Oh, it did. It did.
There
we had
units
two.
All over the place.
There were two, sometimes three full crews going, because then we had an A and B stories happening in the thing. And I mean, it was it was big. It was big, and it was a lot of good training. I'd completely forgotten about that.
So I mean, when you got the shoot, and from when the series ended, I mean, you, how was that growth period like? Do you feel, I mean, you obviously learned something, people do, but do you feel you were really green at the beginning and didn't know as much, and did you get it down to like an art by the end? Because you had to roll fast too, right?
Uh-huh. And that hasn't changed. I've got to say that my my mother's upbringing and putting me into drama and everything gave me an appreciation for actors. And she wanted me to be something better than a tradesman. My dad wanted me to be a tradesman. And I wish he would have been a little bit more forceful, because sometimes as a freelancer, when you have the slack periods, it would have been nice to have something to fall back on. But anyhow, but I understood with that training and everything, I understood drama. And I think that that helps a heck of a lot in how I shoot, and to understand and visualize when I read a script pretty fast what that visualization is, you know. And, you know, it helped to go fast. I mean, but we were all learning. I mean, everybody was learning, you know, directors, everybody. Was learning. I mean, without mentioning any names, we were hauled into the producer's office one day, and the director and I, and he's a wonderful director, and I loved him. We loved working together, and we used to turn out great stuff, because we had great stories on Top Cops that were given to us, and good drama stuff, gritty bars and motels and all that. Anyhow, we were running behind, and we were hauled into the office at the end of the day, and we read the riot act, and I'm standing there, and the director answers the producer and said, "How can I block a scene when it's not lit?" And I looked at him, and I looked at the producer. The producer looked at me. Everybody knew you got to block the scene to be able to light it. And all of a sudden he went, "Oh." And we all started laughing, and we walked out. He said it with such deliverance that, you know, are you a dummy or something?
So, did you know any other cinematographers, you know, when you were doing these series that you conferred with? Was there any influences, you know, when you were starting to shoot? I mean, there were so many contemporaries that you had, and you were probably all learning, too.
Yeah, you know, I kind of worked closely with my gaffers, because when it came down to it, we were the two to have to get it done. So I used to confer with the gaffer quite a bit. The grip department was always necessary, but it was second place, because, you know, you didn't need to worry about that until you had the scene lit, you know. I mean, okay, so, you know, you relied a bit on, well, in those days I was operating and DPing, so I relied on the dolly grip to set the dolly and set it right, but my most focus was on the look, and, you know, whereas you'd sort of try and do the both things and work together with the camera, but you're in the viewfinder all the time. We didn't have monitors. It was through the lens that you lit your scene, you know. So you'd be walking along as the dolly drips, trying to, you know, work the dolly and finesse the dolly and get it smooth and everything. You'd be trying to light it. Because the speed was incredible. And what we shot in those days and the scenes we did in those days were humongous. But great, you know, some of them great. Some of them were not so great. But, you know, for the most part, because you wanted it to look good, because if, you know, that was your stamp.
So today you shoot in digital, because you've shot and you come from film background. So, you know, what was your first project in digital, and how was that transition for you?
I was fortunate to do my first project in digital with a lovely director, John Badham, American director who's quite a technical gentleman, and the digital was coming up. It wasn't, it was like on the border. But he wanted to. He could foresee this was going to happen. He wanted to be first in, and so we did this movie down in Halifax, of all places. But you know, you couldn't have hoped for a better director, because he understood the lighting. He understood everything. You know, he'd done big shows like Bird on a Wire, and Yeah, he knew that it was going to take time to light because he knew that it was finicky and everything like that. So one of the fortunate things that we had was an old, I think it was RCMP building that was up for demolition and was going to be converted into condominiums or something. So we were able to do anything with it. We were able, in all the rooms, because he wanted to do a steady cam shot all the way through this house. And we were able to put a grid in everything. Drill in, hang a grid. We had everything numbered and everything everything on dimmer boards and whatever. So we were able to... We were able to, for the Steadicam, we were able to do a very fine job. Because in those days, the latitude was not great.
So digital.
In the digital, no. Right.
So you were almost maybe having to be as accurate as film or like...
More accurate. More. You had, in those days, I mean, you had more latitude. You had at least almost 9 stops in film. You maybe had 3 stops. In the digital.
So did it frustrate you because of the lack of latitude? And did you use your meter?
Oh, I used my meter today.
Yeah, and you used it on that drone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Big time.
Yeah.
Big time. Because a lot of times, you know, when you're working fast and everything like that, it's quicker. You know that you can set a sudden exposure, and you used your meter all the time on film, so it was sort of second nature. I still use it because sometimes the cameras aren't ready. So, but you got to keep working to light the set.
So use it today for your lights.
Yeah. And when the cameras come and they're set and whatever, then
yeah, you know what you've pretty much got
the base in. So then, you know, when you see the shot, you can fine tune, but you got to keep moving. So, yeah, the meter comes out.
I guess what do you set it to?
Like 800.
800.
Yeah.
So that's your base go-to. And so when you're shooting digital, is that what you always
set? Yep. See, when I shot film, I was always a believer in giving a good negative. If you wanted to do bleach bypass and play with it, you're better off to play with a print than play with a negative. If you did it right off the top and it didn't work, you were kind of...
Screwed.
I'm glad you said that. So I kind of do that today as well. You know, it's very rare that I'll go away from 800 and go up to 1600 or anything like that, because you can push that in post. But you know, digital is fun. I mean, you know, I'm a great believer that what's on the front of the camera, lenses, that is, are the most important thing for me. If you've got good lenses, you're going to get good pictures. And that's good when you come up to a project that you say, yeah, maybe I need to go with that camera because of that one particular thing that it'll do. But generally, I like to, you know, rely on my lighting. And like I did just recently, I did a film called Wedding in the Vineyard. We did some beautiful stuff, which was late evening at 3 o'clock in the afternoon by playing with grads and exposure and lighting.
Not so much the camera.
Not so much the camera.
Right. In front.
You know, and it was just balance. But we were able to, instead of having to wait for the light, we were able to create it probably better than if we would have waited, because then you only have a limited time. Whereas this way, you could work into that period of time.
Right.
By dropping a filter, by opening up a stop. And, you know, it was rather fun. Mm-hmm. And you walk away from it and go home, go to bed, because you've seen it. You know, rather than the old days where if the call was 7 o'clock, you were there at 6 o'clock saying, have the rushes come in yet?
That's right. Well, you know, the days of filtration. I mean, there was the decades of, it was a serious thing.
Yeah.
Filters. Everyone had their grads, the NDs and the tobaccos.
That's right.
You know, and you were shooting in that time.
That's right.
So you must have had a whole set yourself.
Yeah.
And where are they now?
They're still with me.
That's good.
Still with me. You know, you have to be a little careful on filtration today with digital because it reads so well. A lot of times, you know, I'll just pass. I'll always carry ND, soft NDs, because, you know, I can put the color in later. Because I have the luxury that I can go to my own color timing, or I work with a colorist that knows exactly my language, and I can send notes and do it, and then they'll send me stills and I can check it out and say yeah that's nice, you know.
Do you use onset dit?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
How you're saying that the digital reads filters more. So do you think that the filter...
It reads the color, more the color filters than anything, you know. So you got to be a little careful. Like, I still use them, but you got to be a little careful that they don't pop too much. And they go, oh, there's a filter, you know. I mean, I like to keep things looking natural.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That, you know, unless you were told there was a filter in there. That's kind of from the old-fashioned, or not old-fashioned, but old-school training, that, you know, my photography should be great, but it shouldn't be noticeable. It's the person in front of the camera that should be noticeable, or the persons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you shouldn't be thinking about the lighting.
I shouldn't be looking at the photographers, like, wow, that's beautiful, and these two poor people who are giving lines and everything are not being noticed.
The greatest cinematography, you don't even notice it.
No. No. And that's why I liked Conrad Hall. You know, I thought The Road to Perdition was, like, excellent, fantastic photography. But the story was, I was glued to that story. I had to go and see that two or three times just to study the photography.
Right. First to watch just the narrative and absorb the film, and then the next to sort of...
If I go to a movie and I'm looking to see where the key's coming from, that movie hasn't made it for me.
Yeah, it takes a strong narrative so the lighting can serve that story.
Yeah, and that's kind of where the word team comes from. You know, it all blends together. It blends with the director, with what the producers are looking for, but more so with the director and DP. And then you bring, you know, your gaffer in and production designers in there, your set decorators in there. They're the key people that are going to make a good-looking movie.
Well, when you first read a script, do you do a few read-throughs, or how do you approach the first read?
Some of them try to get through it. I'm joking. No, some you've got to read a couple of times, but then there's some that you can't put down, and they're the great ones.
And at that time, you're not?
At that time. When I read something, I'm reading visually.
Right,
and
okay,
so it takes a long time for me to read it because I've already started to
start thinking about
it. I'm already starting to light it and get into it. So if I'm starting to light it and get into it and visualizing, the script is good, but it takes me a long time. It could take me 3 days to read a script.
And do you find that your instincts for the lighting, and then when you finally meet with the director to talk about that, what is the result generally?
You know what? It's, I don't know whether it's a compliment, or maybe it is. I'm going to take it as a compliment anyhow. But not too many people discuss lighting with me. I'm not sure whether they're scared of me. Where, like, with what I'm doing these days, I mean, I'm not going to say that if I haven't met you before, you're directing a show, that we wouldn't sit down and talk, look and everything like that. But with the body of work that I've been doing, which has been for Hallmark, I'm trusted. I can go in and light something the way I feel it should be lit. I can live on the edge a little bit. I just did a show called Chronicles, one of the things that I made quite clear was that if I was to do this, because it's a series of shows, that I didn't want to have to copy. I wanted to go in and put my own thing to the show, and I did, and I had fun with it, and it worked out really well.
And what was the narrative that made you take that approach?
It was new. It was, it read like a 1940s detective series movie kind of thing. It, you know, the whole script kind of felt that it should be a little on the dark side and a little edgy to give it, you know, to give it the flavor. And I think it worked. I mean, they were happy.
Oh, I'll have to look out for that. That sounds great. I like that, you know, you challenged yourself. You did something different. That
yeah.
That's kind of fun.
You know, and I'll be honest, I've played it pretty straight throughout my career just because of the politics. You know, and maybe that was harmful to myself. I should have got edgier much earlier in my life. I should have pushed the envelope much earlier in my life. But we were working so fast, so in those days, you know, when you talk, I mean, Top Cops, I played the edges a bit, for sure. But there's some shows that, you know, you just can feel that if you go off track, maybe you're going to you're gonna be totally off track, you know. Thanks very much. Goodbye. I don't know. You know, I still think I've done good photography. Hey, I'm 74. I'm still doing it. But now at 74, I want to get edgy. I want to get a little bit out of the envelope. You know, now I'm having fun with it.
That's great.
I mean, it's a whole new life for me as a DP. That I want to do it the right way.
I think that's just beautiful what you just said. You
know, yeah.
Reaching that point, and you've got so much experience behind you. You're comfortable. When did you get your letters? Like, was it a long time ago?
Long time ago. I got them in that period of when I was doing documentaries all over the world. I can remember. Well, I won Best Documentary Cameraman back in the, I guess it would have been the 70s, but I can remember it. And I'd won Best Documentary Cameraman for a documentary I'd done called Creative Spirit, which at that time was a lovely documentary. I worked with David Lee, was Academy Award winner David Lee. And I can remember being in Stockholm. I was on another show with Rennie Bonnier, an oldie goldie, and I got a call from Eddie Higginson, who's just left us and shooting movies up there somewhere in the clouds. And they were at the CSC gala event, and they said, "You've just won the best documentary." And then I got a second call. And it was from my wife. It said, "I've sold the house. You don't have anywhere to live when you come home." But that's been my life, you know, ups and downs.
This has been the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. The CSC is a nonprofit organization that has been promoting the art and craft of cinematography in Canada since 1957. Find out more by logging on to thecsc.ca. Thank you for joining us.